You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
It'll be 60 years this coming October since Mao Zedong marked the beginning of the Chinese Revolution with these simple words, "The Chinese people have stood up." It was in 1949 that the Chinese people embarked on the construction of a socialist society. But rarely indeed are the Chinese people's experiences of trying to build a socialist society brought forward as relevant for today. Today, when socialism is discussed, more often than not, a phrase is added, socialism for the 21st century. Hari Sharma believes Chinese experiences should be studied and discussed by all interested in building a new world, a human alternative to capitalism and empire. And to that end, he's organized a symposium titled China During the Mao and Post-Mao Periods, A People's Perspective. And the symposium will take place next Saturday at the downtown campus of SFU. Hari Sharma is an emeritus professor at Simon Fraser University, and he joins me on the phone from his home. Good morning and welcome back to Red Eye, Hari.
Good morning to you, Mordecai, and to your listeners.
Now, I mentioned that Chinese experiences of trying to build a socialist society are little discussed or studied presently. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it is not quite that way around the world. There are a lot of places in the world where Chinese experiences of building socialism and also the negative experiences of having to see that socialist path being abandoned in the later half of the 60-year period, those things are very seriously being studied by people in many countries of Asia and Latin America. It's only in the Western world, I suppose, in the advanced capitalist societies that you don't see much of a discourse going on what happened in China. In fact, it is kind of a very sad and painful experience for me to see my colleagues in the academic community, particularly those associated with the Committee of Concerned Asian Scholars or the Bulletin of Concerned Asian Scholars, who were China hands and who had tremendously favorable view of what China was doing. In fact, they broke the barrier which American government had imposed, traveled into China illegally, and came back with a glowing report of what China was doing to its people. Now, those people are not anymore so enamored. In fact, on the contrary, they are beginning to see that what Deng Xiaoping did perhaps was good for the Chinese people. I don't know why is it so. There are a lot of other things one could say, but I think it is important that people, wherever they are, if they are concerned about the savagery of capitalism, if they are sick and tired of this exploitative system, if they are deep down looking for alternative ways of running a society, then I think it is very important to learn from those lessons, learn some lessons from those experiences where these efforts were being made and in fact were made very successfully. China happens to be one of those cases, a very successful revolutionary transformation that took place. And I think this symposium will definitely bring out the important, significant aspects of those success stories.
Well,
if they are heard from the point of view of the ordinary masses of China.
Well, let's look at that a little more detail. What kinds of experiences do you think are particularly relevant to the present effort to build a new society, the experiences in China?
Well, once again, I wish to reiterate that the Chinese experiences cannot necessarily be transplanted to an advanced industrial capitalist society like Canada, U.S. It's a very different kind of a social formation. Different kind of alliances, etc., have to be built. Different strategies may have to be taken. But the Chinese Revolution shows several things. Number one, that it is possible that it is possible to bring to end the role of imperialism and its comprador classes in a dependent society, in a semi-colonial colonial society, that it is possible to capture political power, that it is possible to turn that state machinery into the service of the ordinary masses, and it is possible to actually realize those things. So if we are interested in socialism, even in or the concept of socialism, even in Vancouver, Canada, anywhere, then to draw lessons from what that vision was. How was it possible to use the state machinery to bring about policies which would directly be benefiting the Chinese masses? And these are relevant for us today. And when you hear concepts like socialism for the 21st century, I think these centuries are artificial marks, you know, milestones. I don't know whether they have any significance or not. History is a continuous flow. One who denies history denies present, or does not quite fully grasp the present. So you cannot build a socialist experimental process, whether it is here in Canada or in Venezuela or in Mexico or in India or in China today, without learning sufficiently as to how it was done, what actually was achieved, and how it got derailed. Things do get derailed. And why? The most important question is not only that Chinese made the revolution, equally important question is, why did it get derailed? Why did people like Deng Xiaoping manage to come to power? Is it because China was not fit for revolution? Nonsense. Is it because Chinese leadership of Mao Zedong did not create enough instrumentalities? That again is nonsense, and yet it got derailed. And that question needs to be asked. If you are building socialism here or trying to build socialism here, one has to ask those questions. How do you consolidate?
One of the questions that concerns people a great deal today who are looking for an alternative world is the kind of political organization which can contribute to that. And they tend to look negatively at things like the Communist Party and the Communist Party in China. Is there something from that experience of the Chinese struggle in that dimension that you think is worth more study and more reflection?
I definitely think so. Although in the present phase of contemporary history, living in advanced industrial societies, the word communism, the word Communist Party somehow instantly, spontaneously brings out a reaction. But I don't think it is ever going to be possible for a society at a societal level to lead a revolutionary struggle for socialism against capitalism or imperialism without an organized political force, whether you want to call it a communist party or whatever you want to call it. It has to be led by an organized, systematic, well-disciplined communist people's force, which can bring together diverse elements in society, which can deal with negativities present in society, which can encourage positivities. I think the essential role of an organized force, a political party, is very, very, very crucial. I think one can draw distinction. Look at the liberation struggles which took place in the 60s and 70s, which were invariably led by communist parties or workers' parties, like in Vietnam. They brought about not only victory, but also laid the foundation for building a socialist alternative, although many factors took place, and we don't have time, you don't have time, I don't have time to go into it. But then an anti-imperialist struggle, which took place in Vietnam or in Laos or in Cambodia, which were led by organized political forces, workers' parties or communist parties, did have the successful result. Because, on the other hand, there are a lot of anti-imperialist struggles going on today, sometimes in the name of Islamic fundamentalism, sometimes in the name of just nationalism, but they don't necessarily lead to, like what happened in Algeria. Like what happened, they did throw away the French colonial rule, but since they were not led by a Marxist political party, they did not manage to consolidate a people's regime in Algeria compared to, let's say, Vietnam.
Tell us about the speakers you've invited to the symposium and what you think they can contribute to our understanding of the Chinese experience.
Well, one of the speakers is locally from here, Dr. Zhao. She is teaching in the communications department at SFU. She has done a tremendous amount of work. Her field is communications, but her work is definitely in political economy. She uses the tools of communication in the post-Mao period, how the communication field or industry has been used to consolidate the revisionist leadership and consolidate the capitalist restoration. Brilliant work she has been doing. But then the other three scholars who are coming from outside, one is Dr. Pao Yu Jing, professor emeritus from Detroit in economics, and she has been constantly visiting China. She's very close relationship with the leadership in the Chinese Communist movement, and she's written extensively. She's coming and going to speak as to what was the nature of the worker-peasant alliance in the post-revolutionary period. How did the Chinese leadership manage to create a model of economic development which was simultaneously development of agriculture and industry in an integrated manner? That needs to be elaborated quite at length, and we don't have time. Then we have Ding-Fing Han. He's coming from Carolina. He is Chinese. He actually grew up on a Chinese village, in a cooperative farm, in the Cultural Revolution period. He owes his education, subsequently his visit to America, got an MA, got a PhD. He says that if he had not been born in that particular time in history, he would have never gone to school in China, either before or after. Before Cultural Revolution or after Cultural Revolution. I think a tremendous amount of work this man has done. He has gone back again and again and again to his own village, his own county, and he's produced a wonderful book as to what were the gains, significant gains of Cultural Revolution. Cultural Revolution is supposed to be seen, not supposed, is seen as something kind of a horrible experience, and that's what Deng Xiaoping and other people have been able to successfully portray, because they had to do it that way. But this man, very worth listening to, will tell his experiences of living in a collective commune, in a cooperative community, and his research as to how wonderful it was and how successful it was to transform and empower the people in a manner which was unprecedented in Chinese history. In fact, I would imagine unprecedented in any history anywhere in the world. Then you have this Dr. Robert Weil. He lives in California, is a teacher, works at a university, also an activist. He has been following Chinese developments over many years. His book, one of the books is famous, Red Cat, White Cat, following Deng Xiaoping's characterization that doesn't matter what color the cat is as long as it catches the mouse. And he shows the contradictions of the post-Mao, in the period of Deng Xiaoping and beyond, how socialism has systematically been destroyed.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Hari, and I'll give people further information about the conference itself.
And they have to, hopefully they can register in advance.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mordecai, and thank you, the listeners.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Hari Sharma. He's emeritus professor at Simon Fraser University and a founding member of SANSAD, that's the South Asia Network for Secularism and Democracy. The symposium he was discussing is titled China During the Mao and Post-Mao Periods, A People's Perspective. It'll take place next Saturday, March 28th, at the downtown campus of Simon Fraser University, beginning at 1 p.m. and continuing until 6 p.m., from 1 to 6. The room number is 2270.